65. Tim felt it first. He'd noticed the hum weeks ago. It was a subtle vibration, the kind you got on a plane or large ship, a hint that there were things going on under the floor. When he felt the change, he knew it was something that had been going on for 10 or 15 minutes. That was a bad sign. It used to be that nothing could sneak up on him. The hum was a little faster, a little higher pitched, just enough he was sure it had changed. The vibration was different, too. Since he first noticed it, the ever-so-faint tremble had been clean and steady. It synced with the hum. Now they'd fallen apart and become two distinct elements. The vibration was slowing and becoming less steady. It was more of a low thrum now, like a guitar. It was as if he could feel the pulse of the building, and the building was... Tim's mind snapped into crisis mode. He ran into his small bedroom, threw some shoes aside, and pulled a high-impact case from under the bed. Three combinations leaped to mind, a different one for each lock, and he spun the first dial. Nate and Veek might have noticed sooner if they hadn't been distracted in the kitchen and then on the futon couch. As it was, they became aware of the change at the same moment Tim was throwing open the case from under his bed. Nate stood to drag his pants up and paused with his hand on the zipper. "Do you feel that?" he asked. Like a throbbing, kind of? Veek pulled her shirt over her head and smirked. "If you're fishing for compliments, I think you got enough while we were—" "No, seriously." He gave his fly a quick tug, buttoned the jeans, and crouched next to Veek's bare legs. She still wore her socks. He set his hand on the floor. "It feels like someone's blasting their stereo downstairs."
"I don't hear anything."
He shook his head. "Neither do I, but that sure feels like a big set of speakers." She set her own feet down and took a few quick steps to where her jeans had landed. The lights were out, but the windows were wide open.
"Yeah," she said. "It does. What the heck is that?"
Nate grabbed his shirt from the kitchen floor. In his drying rack, two glasses were trembling. They started to clatter against each other. "Is it an earthquake?"
"No," she said, stepping into her pant legs. "If it was an earthquake, it'd..."
Her voice trailed off and her eyes went wide behind her glasses.
"Oh, shit."
Someone pounded on the door, any harder, and whoever it was would be trying to break the door down. They glanced at each other. "Who is it?" shouted Nate.
"It's Tim," he hollered. "I think we've got a problem."
Zila saw it next. Her headphones were in, and the pounding voice of Jesse J was blocking out all other sounds and sensations. She was working on another painting of the building. This was her third in as many weeks, acrylics on canvas. For such a fascinating subject, she couldn't come up with a way to picture it that didn't feel trite or overused. The canvas in front of her was a mix of architecture lines and circuit boards. She'd been shooting for an optical illusion. It looked like crap. A wave of despair washed over her, but she managed to get above it. Art was her destiny. She knew it for a fact. She just needed to get past this creative block. The light in her apartment shifted as the streetlights came on. There was one right by her front window that lit up her place at night. It was crappy yellow light, though, way too diffuse and scattered to be any good. In all truth, she knew she hadn't created anything worthwhile in months, nothing that felt good enough anyway. One of her teachers had told her being able to accept your work was no good was a vital step, a sign of growth and maturity in an artist. Zila was very ready for the next vital step. She toyed with the idea of grabbing her stubby little roller and covering the whole thing with titanium white. It'd be awesome to be able to cut canvases to shreds with a knife or to smash their frames and burn them, probably a great emotional release. She couldn't afford new canvases, though. As it was, she had to work with the cheapy ones from Michael's Crafts, and she had to paint over those four or five times until they were too stiff to use. The streetlight flared. For a moment she thought it had burned out, but then it went back to its regular levels. Then it flashed again. And a third time. Zila glanced out the window and all thoughts of painting vanished from her mind. She yanked out her headphones and the hum assaulted her ears. She dashed into the hall just in time to see Nate and Veek following Tim down the back stairwell. Mandy sat at her computer and checked her credit score. Someone had told her they were updated once every 4 or 5 days, but she was sure the bad news got updated more often. The news of Mrs. Knight moving out had convinced Mandy she was guilty by association. Everyone knew the banks and the government were one big socialist group, so it made sense they'd try to damage her score even more now. While she waited for the website, the screen jumped, like an old television. The image scrolled up and back so fast she could have blinked and missed it. But Mandy hadn't blinked, and she'd also heard the low, distant rumble. She looked away from the monitor and saw the summer evening had become dark and dreary. A haze of fog hung outside her window, and she heard another rumble of thunder. This one shook the building. And the building kept shaking. Her window panes started to rattle. She heard someone bang on the door across the hall, Nate's door. There were raised voices and running footsteps. Her computer screen went blank and her heart sank. She should have unplugged it at the first sign of thunder. She wouldn't be able to get it fixed unless Veek would be willing to fix it in exchange for, well, whatever Mandy could give her that she wanted. Then the monitor lit back up. Mandy took a relieved breath, and then her heart sank again. The screen was all nonsense. Green squiggles scrolled up the screen. They looked like Chinese or Muslim or one of those languages that used chicken scratch instead of proper letters. Her whole room was shaking and the roar of thunder wouldn't stop. Her tall lamp tipped over and a picture of her parents dropped off the wall. Out of the corner of her eye, she could see flashes of lightning through the fog. A circle appeared on the monitor. It was filled with more squiggles, and the squiggles moved across the computer screen like little worms. Or little tentacles. Andrew stood before the control panel. Auntie Bradbury had given him the honor of shutting the machine down, but it didn't feel right to do it all by himself. That would be selfish. This was a joyous moment which needed to be shared with as many people as possible. He'd insisted Auntie be first. The old woman had smiled with pleasure, selected a large lever, and pulled it down. Debbie and Clive had yelled and shouted. They still didn't understand what was going on. Clive fought to his feet, but Charles grabbed his arm and Andrew punched him once in the stomach. Clive dropped back to the floor. Zebediah and Lucas each picked a knob and gave them a hard twist. Howard set his hand across a row of switches and pushed them all down. Charles pulled another lever, and then Andrew flipped down every switch he could see. One needle pegged itself to the far side of the dial, another swung back and forth like an inverted pendulum. One twitched between 30 and 40. They all heard the arcs of electricity behind the panels and saw the flashes. The machine howled and the air in the building roared back. Andrew could see the sky changing outside the windows, and for the first time in his life, his faith was rewarded with the sight of one of his lords soaring in the sky by the dying sun. He reached out to either side and held hands with Auntie Bradbury and Brother Charles. The group formed a chain in front of the control panel. Auntie led them in a prayer.
At last, Andrew thought, the time is right.
Roger parked his truck and walked home down Beverly. Home before 9 on a Friday, it was going to be a good weekend. He'd expected to see midnight on set. There were 10 2/8 pages on the call sheet for that day. The whole crew had started the day with doom hanging over them. But the actors had their shit down today and the director had kicked serious ass. He'd minimized setups. He rearranged the call sheet so they could block shoot 3 scenes. 2 of the others he did as oneers. The assistant director called the martini shot at 7:30, and even with a last-minute olive, they'd wrapped by 8:09. A few of the guys had invited him out for drinks, and Roger'd been surprised how cool it felt to tell them his woman and some friends were already waiting on him. He pressed the button for the walk signal and glanced up Kenmore towards his home. All thoughts of Thai food and movies and fooling around with Zila up on the sun deck under the stars vanished. The Kavach building was glowing. At first he thought everyone had their lights on, but it was the building itself. A flicker raced around the edges of each brick, the way static chased fingertips across an old television screen. Roger took a moment to check traffic and then crossed the street against the light. By the time he reached the far curb, he was running. Power hung in the air. It prickled his skin and tugged at his hair. He could feel the hum in his teeth and hear glass trembling in the windows. A few people from nearby buildings looked out windows or stood out on their stoops. There was a crowd gathered around the gate, almost 2 dozen men and women Roger didn't know. He sprinted past the green Taurus, noticed its airbag had gone off, and was at the fence. Roger shoved through the crowd in the open gate. Some of them grabbed at him, and he let them pull away his tool belt and backpack. A woman yanked at his arm, and he slammed his fist into her face. He forced his way up the front steps. The air around the building was clotted like old milk or blood. It felt like he was pushing through millions of invisible bees, each one letting its razor-sharp stinger brush across his skin. The air roared at him, warning him to stay back, and Roger yanked open the security door and dove into the lobby.
Just in time, he told himself.
He didn't question how he knew this.
The Kavach building shuddered and groaned. It bent in ways brick and stone and concrete weren't supposed to bend. It twisted along angles most human minds couldn't comprehend. It let out a long howl, and then, like a spinning top that built up enough speed to leap up off the ground and into the third dimension for a moment, the building shifted in space. And it was somewhere else.